Before we start with today's episode, I want to address a common challenge that I've noticed among HVACR professionals. They often struggle to keep up with the advancements in heat pump technologies. That's why here at the ESCO Group, along with the HVACR Learning Network, we have an amazing library of courses to equip you with the essential skills for handling today's inverter-driven heat pumps. And better yet, we're offering free access to the first two chapters of our most popular course on the fundamentals of high-performance heat pumps. Check out the link in the show notes to get your free access.
Builders have learned that. They've had lawsuits. There's messes against builder, you know, the bigger is not better strategy, right? If you take a moment to understand this technology, it is something that every HVAC contractor has been asking for since the dawn of their careers. If I had a system that could change its capacity and only make what's needed when it's needed, and therefore only use the power that it needs to do that, I got what I want. I got a system that when it's cloudy outside, can make less heating or cooling, or, you know, cooling if we're in AC mode. Well, then when it's sunny and hot, it can make more. And so that allows contractors to stop doing what I call, you know, one of my peers, dear peers, calls mechanical malpractice.
This episode brought to you by LG and their lineup of high-performance HVAC products. Learn more at lghvac.com.
Well, hello, HVACR community. We're so grateful that you're spending time with us once again, hanging out on Did You Know the ESCO HVAC Show. So we've been listening to your requests. We're bringing in our manufacturers. We're talking about some of the difficult topics from the industry. And one that we have had requests for, and when I had a conversation with Phil about topics, we're like, let's talk about some installation issues. Let's talk about some best practices. Let's talk about some of the things that we'll encounter while we're out in the field that can help us as educators in particularly as we're implementing new products into the classroom. Todd, great for being on here today. Thank you so much for joining in South California. I know you're a little ways off from where the fires are, but only like 80 miles or so. So yeah, you be careful out there and make sure you're breathing some good quality air. And for everyone that's joining us, we really want to know where you're joining from. Tell us if you have any questions along the way, things that we need to dive deeper into. You know, I also put that QR, I'll throw that out there so that it stays in the background. I'm wanting some more input from you of topics that we need to cover in 2025, particular pieces of equipment, particular types of technologies. We're here for you, and we want to make sure that you're getting all of the tools that you need to be successful. All right, so today we've got some very special guests from LG, first time on this show. Phil, it was wonderful hanging out with you doing a podcast. It's going to be released on Friday. Phil is the Senior Business Development Manager for LG. And what really intrigues me for both you and Terry, Terry, the Executive Sales Manager at LG, both you guys are on the business side of development, but you're tech at heart, and it doesn't get any better than that. All right, a bunch of people joining in. Patrick Murphy up in Jersey Shore. We got George. George, I don't know if I've seen you on here before. George from Western Kentucky, thanks for joining us today. Have any questions, let us know. Paul Leonardi, he's a trooper. I need to get Paul on here all the time. Paul actually brings enough questions, it makes me think sometimes. Look, he's there to make sure things are staying top-notch. Katie, thanks for joining us again. Oh, Katie, I seen an email that came across with Howard about from tutus to tool belts, which I'd love to talk to you about sometime. We want to make sure we get some coverage on that. And guys, Katie's one of our educators over in Missouri and has a program for young girls called From Tutus to Tool Belts. Oh, bring them in. And they've got like torches. They're actually brazing stuff. They're flaring. And they're like 10, 12 years old. And they're just killing it. So it's a fantastic program. Hey, Michael, thank you for joining in also from California. Hey, and how are you? Are you good clear areas? Are you being affected by it? Because I know there's a lot of people that's suffering out there. And we really are very grateful for them of the situations that we have. Hey, fantastic. We're grateful for you joining us again, Osvaldo. I've seen you quite a few times here from Belize. And Kendrick, man, Kendrick, are you going to be at the conference? If so, I'd love to hook up with you. Jason keeps telling me that we got to get together and talk sometimes. He says you're just an absolute hoot to hang out with. Russell, thank you for joining down in Amarillo, Texas, getting some of that snow as well. I know all sorts of interesting weather happening around here. So Terry, where are you joining us from today?
I am joining you from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. My youngest son is a surgeon in the Navy. He's in Japan snowboarding, and my wife and I are here watching his dog.
Oh, there you go. That's a little good little getaway. Yeah, my brother was born in Camp Lejeune. My dad was a Marine back in 49 to 51 and was stationed down there at Camp Lejeune.
Yeah, it's full circle for me. Listen, my dad was a Marine helicopter pilot, and I actually went to high school here and spent a lot of time, 11 years in this community when I was growing up, fifth grade to sophomore in college.
Fantastic. Well, we're grateful to have you here with us today. So tell me a little bit about yourself too. You know, what's going on? Tell me about your background in industry before we get into education. I always love to learn more about people.
I'll tell you. So I graduated high school in 1975 and thought I was going to go surfing here in North Carolina. My mom had a different plan for me. She woke me up that morning, the first morning after high school, said, get in a car, drove me to downtown Jacksonville, North Carolina, said, get out, get a job, come home.
Here's life.
until you have one. Now, obviously, that was a long time ago, so there was no Indeed. There was no, you went out and knocked on doors to try to get a job.
Yeah.
So I think the third door I walked in was Jacksonville Heating and Cooling and Roofing. And I started in the roofing department for about a week and saw the AC guys coming home every night in their truck with their little uniforms and thought, man, I'd like to get into that trade.
Yep.
So that was 1975, and here I am.
Absolutely love that. Phil, where are you joining us from today?
So I'm in Canton, Georgia, up northwest Georgia.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's your experience in the industry? I'm always intrigued how people, because we never, most of the people that have been here for more than 10 years never really end up where they started, which is, I love that because there's so many places to go to.
Fell into it by accident. It was a, I was 10 years in the insurance industry and had a good stable job and just wasn't sure what was next for me, and ended up at a men's prayer meeting, actually. And one of the guys said, I'm looking to hire a sales guy for my small air conditioning company. I lived in Louisiana at the time, Smith Air Conditioning. And so I called him later that day because my father-in-law had just been laid off and he'd been in sales for his life. And so I started talking to him a little bit, and I realized pretty quickly that it was something that really, really piqued my interest. Yeah. And next thing I know, a week or two goes by, we've had several conversations. I'm out there working for him. It's a small business. So, you know, it wasn't one of those typical sales roles where you're just thrown out there with a big book and you're told to go sell some stuff. He actually made me learn some stuff, which was great. And then a couple little pit stops later and ended up at LG, been here for going on 6 years, done several roles here, started off as one of the area sales managers working with our distributors and our contractors. And then most recently brought over to Terry's team. We are working with single multifamily builders directly. And that's kind of our role, is to specialize in that. So spending some time using building science knowledge, going out, creating relationships with the builders, working with our appliance sales team on the other side of the house at LG to kind of bring those relationships in and just try to make a mark in that new construction world.
Yeah. And there's a lot going on in there, isn't there?
Listen, if I could jump in, I got four guys on our team, and I'll tell you what all four of us have in common. Okay. And it's a phrase that I'll use: from the trenches, turning wrenches.
Oh boy.
Right. So that's where this group of folks that's in this builder sales role at our company, they're all from that background. They all have either owned an air conditioning company themselves, or like Philip, have been employed through various positions at HVAC companies. And I think that gives us a very unique and a very grounded base to apply and sell from. And contractors and builders, they pick up on that very quickly, that these guys actually have tough hands and know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. You can walk the talk, not just talk the walk. Yeah. And both of you going to be at the conference, HVACR Education Conference? I think both of you are going to be there, aren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I can't wait to hang out with you guys. And for everyone in the audience, there's going to be a lot of people in the audience will be joining us. As you can tell, you know, these guys are from our own shirt and tail. You know, this is the kind of people we love to hang out with and learn new things, especially when we're implementing new equipment into the classrooms. I can tell you guys that we get a lot of calls from the industry, especially from educators. We work with about 1,400 schools around the country, but we also work with a lot of distributors and a lot of contractors that have their own training programs. And everyone is starting to be very aware of the transitions we're making in the industry. And so they're, you know, if you think about like myself, like you guys, like we spend time in the industry and then we find ourselves in other roles. And sometimes we have to go back and learn more about the industry to be able to stay up to date. And that's really what the conference is about. That's what this education is about. So we have a lot of educators that were really good contractors, really good technicians. They get into education. They're teaching all the fundamentals. They're teaching them everything they know. And then all of a sudden a new style of equipment comes out and they go, okay, I need some help. I need to learn how to implement this. I haven't installed one of these myself. So I don't know what to tell the students are going to be the issues that they could encounter when they're out in the field. So there's a lot of things that we have an opportunity to help our educators grow into. And that's what today's conversation is going to be about. And I also want everyone to be aware that these guys, are right up my own sidewalk, right? So you got to go check out the LG Procast podcast. I've sit in on a bunch of these podcasts that they put out. And it really is. It's about giving you information, giving you the tools that you need to be successful. So I encourage you to get over there and learn a little bit more about them. And I am so sorry. If I would have known, Terry, for sure that you're going to be here, I would have had you in here. But I guarantee you, I will get this updated. And when the finished video comes out, it'll be the three of us hanging out here. So
awesome.
All right. So let's dive in and let's talk about some very important things. I just grabbed a few slides out of this high-performance heat pump program that we put out here recently. It was an initiative that I worked with a bunch of industry partners and the DOE. and just trying to help the industry be more comfortable with especially high performance heat pumps, right? So things that we need to talk about is load calculations and understanding the loads of the structure. So let's kind of start there and talk about some of the things that could have, there are probably rules of thumb that we've used in past on older generations of equipment that may not apply in today's world.
And Clifton, if you'll allow me, I want to back up before we dive into this too much. You know, I put myself in the shoes of somebody who hasn't really had a lot of experience with inverter-based systems, meaning systems that can, you know, ramp up, ramp down, match the load of the home and all those things. And it seems a little bit scary, but what I want to make sure that we portray the message is that the refrigeration cycle is still the same refrigeration cycle that we've had for 100 years since Willis Carrier blessed us with the air conditioner. And there's not as much to be afraid of once you kind of get to know what's going on. You know, we look at the automotive industry, they went through this change in the 80s and early 90s where we went from carbureted fuel systems where it was manual devices. You know, you'd use your timing light, you'd use your vacuum gauge to adjust that carburetor. And now they're all computer controlled. And we plug in our scanners and we get our little tools out and we look up what those codes mean and they tell us what's going wrong with it. Well, the combustion of the engine has not changed at all. It's how it's managed. It's managing its fuel and air through computers, which makes it much more efficient, has given us longer engine life. And that's what we've done with the air conditioners, what, 30 years later? So yeah. Instead of having thermal expansion valves and single speed compressors that are pumping the same amount of refrigerant at all times, we're now managing our refrigerant flow through computers and electronic expansion valves. And so we're not using our gauges to diagnose it. We're plugging in little tools that'll pop up on your phone, your iPad, your laptop, but it's going to give you that information and a lot more. And what a lot of techs tell me once they really get into it, they said it's actually a lot easier to work on these systems, but it does take some education. So
there's a curve.
It's not this big, scary monster. You know, we do have to know what's going on. Just like all the automotive techs, they had to go back and learn how to use those scan tools and learn what the codes mean. But golly, it made their life a little bit easier. And these are kind of doing the same thing for us now. But and to get into what we're going to talk about, the biggest problem that we really see is when they're not applied properly and they're not installed properly. Exactly. They can be a nightmare. But you install them, you apply it, meaning you size it and you apply it properly and you install it properly, they don't break, you know? I mean, yeah, things can happen, but golly, you put them in right. You talk to the guys that do this on a very regular basis, our LG Pro dealers and guys that are putting this technology in and day out. And they're like, yeah, I'd much rather do one of those because my guys know how to do it. I don't have to go back on. And so I want to take a little bit of that fear out. You know, it's still the same refrigeration cycle, right? We're still turning gas into high pressure and into low pressure. And we're absorbing heat and we're moving it to a different spot and we're letting it go. Nothing's real different. We're just doing it smarter.
So we got the fundamentals checked.
Fundamentals are the same.
We can all go through and go, okay, fundamentals are the same. Heat load calculations, that's gotten easier because we've got, you know, things like technology, like, you know, we got LIDAR now. I can't wait. I'm finishing out about 600 square foot of this barn that I just built down at the farm. And I can't wait until I get it enclosed so I can get in there with some LIDAR and go.
Yeah, we just
3D model.
I know our pro dealer program just partnered with one of those companies called Conduit Tech. And I played around. It's a lot of fun.
That's what I'm talking about. They were on the show a while back, and that's what we discussed. And it's really crucial to start looking at structures and understanding heat loads and rethinking what we do as an industry. Because you know, we were talking, you know, about solutions for homes before the show. And Terry's like, I know the kind of house that you live in, and I've got fantastic solutions for that because a lot of what we're doing in today's construction is not the best practices. And so when we start looking at solutions, we need to understand that we have the solutions, but we just need to get comfortable with how we implement those things and understanding the structures that are going in and looking at the types of solutions that we have. And now we have to teach these in the classroom. That could be a little scary.
So you know what's interesting to me, Clifton, and to your audience is, and since you used the word old and rules of thumb, I'm thinking you're talking directly to me and looking at me because I'm both of those. You know, I grew up from that rule of thumb, man. I grew up with beer can cold, right? I'm that guy that was out there charging 22 until it freaking, you know, was cold out there, and then I'm out of here. But that 400 CFM per ton and that, you know, 500 square feet per ton and all those rules of thumb, they worked somewhat when there were piston-driven systems and constant speed compressors and a lot of room for error, okay? Bigger is not better.
Right? Absolutely not.
Builders have learned that. They have lawsuits. There's messes against builder, you know, the bigger is not better strategy, right? If you take a moment to understand this technology, it is something that every HVAC contractor has been asking for since the dawn of their careers. If I had a system that could change its capacity and only make what's needed when it's needed, and therefore only use the power that it needs to do that, I got what I want. I got a system that when it's cloudy outside can make less heating or cooling, or, you know, cooling if we're in AC mode. Well, then when it's sunny and hot, it can make more. And so that allows contractors to stop doing what I call, you know, one of my peers, dear peers, calls mechanical malpractice. All right. Making a decision to do something that you know in your heart as an HVAC contractor is wrong. But you do it because contractors have a hard time saying this word, no.
Yeah. Oh, my old system didn't keep up. What can you do? Can you give me a half ton bigger unit? That's what they did about 10 years ago, and it made a little bit of a difference. Can you do that again?
And if you look at, you know, if you look at modern HVAC equipment, whether it's our brand or one of the inverter driven brands, or whether it's a US manufacturer, it doesn't really matter. If you look at the, you know, on the ductive product line, if you look at the CFM output of these machines, these air hammers now, they're not putting out 400 CFM a ton at these static pressures, right? They got colder coils, right? Colder coil, slower fan speed. Everybody in the HVAC business knows what that does for cooling. So you have these things happening to technology, ours and traditional products, that are impacting these decisions, which is why this load calc becomes so valuable and so important in making sure whether it's an LG inverter-driven system or a U.S. manufacturer's system, sizing it properly, and to Phillip's point, installing it properly, it's going to make sure that the consumer gets what they paid for.
No, 100%. And so if we haven't already implemented modern heat load calculations into our classroom, now's the time. So as we start talking about, you know, what are our options, as we start looking at our structure slightly different, you know, we have too often designed our systems for a single central ducted system. And now we have the opportunity to look at technology and equipment a little bit different and start thinking about those individual loads that are within our structures and start focusing on the equipment. Now, that's one thing. But when we start talking about the installations and the practices that we should be teaching in the classroom, that's where things have changed. So let's talk a little bit about, like, flaring practices that probably you and I grew up with that don't necessarily meet the bar in today's world.
You know, I'll jump in there for a second. I can tell you that the flaring degree of flaring angle was 33 degrees for all flares, pneumatic, oxygen, didn't matter. Okay. R410A refrigerant came along, and not the offshore manufacturers, but a US manufacturer decided that 410A operated at higher pressure, which it does, right? That the flare needed to change from 33 degrees to 45 degrees. In that first wave of conversion, no one had 45 degree flaring tools. So everybody was making a flare with 33 degrees. And if you could see my fingers, I have a little child's play analogy I do where three fingers trying to slide into four. And then when you tighten it down, that three fingers split underneath the flare. All right. And it's a headache. Flares leak. But you know what? If I go out and do critically charged refrigeration systems today, guess what? They're flare fittings because those components need to be changed and removed. And, you know, and I know Phillip will talk a little bit more about that flaring process on the torque side. This is where it breaks down.
Yeah, it really does. Now, when we look at why ductless systems started to get a bad reputation when they were first installed, or flared style connections when they first were introduced into the market, everyone that I did site investigations for systems that were poorly performing didn't have anything to do with equipment. Didn't matter the manufacturer. It almost always came back to proper flaring and proper torquing. And so in the classroom, we really need to be using proper tools and proper training. And if anyone is needing assistance with that, that's why we're making these connections with LG and manufacturers and tool manufacturers to make sure that you have all of the information you need for these successful installations, not just in the classroom, but out in the field as well.
Tools have come a long way. I mean, the flaring tools, I mean, we still have flaring blocks, but now they have orbital flares that make a nicer flare with a clutch. So you supposedly don't over tighten it. They've got electric powered flare guns that are really fun to play around with. But yeah, to your point, we've got to start teaching it because that's, you know, you said that was something that happened when they first came out. Well, it's still happening. You know, still today, I get call after call after call that, golly, this flare's leaking. I found a system that's low on refrigerant. That is one of the weak points. And flares can work phenomenally well. You know, we have showroom trailers with units that are hooked up and running. And I think that trailer did like 14 or 16,000 miles last year all over the country, bumping around and bouncing around. And we don't have a leak in it. It still runs. It still performs. There's no leaks in our refrigerant. If your flares are leaking, then we need to stop and look at the process. And I don't think it's being taught like it was a long time ago. And then it went out of style to teach flaring and it's back. So as educators, we need to make sure that that's not just a 5-minute pit stop in our curriculum, but there needs to be some hands-on with flaring, how to properly deburr it, as simple as which way to hold the pipe when you're running that deburring tool to make sure that your shavings don't fall in the pipe. I've seen an entire system and they spent days and days trying to figure this thing out, and it wrecked the whole system because there were some brass shavings or copper shavings that got in the system. It had a branch box, and that's where they ended up at the expansion valve. And I mean, it took forever to figure that out. Long story short, they changed the branch box. System works great again, but it was all just because of that little copper shaving in there. So we've got to start with the basics, making sure that we actually put these tools in the students' hands. Give them a torque wrench and let them see what it looks like. You know, the small line, the quarter inch line is, and I'm pulling this out of my memory, so I may be off, but I think it's like 11 to 14 foot pounds of torque is all that's required on that small line. Is that right? About?
So yeah, depends on what size we're working. If it's quarter, we're typically, now this is one manufacturer, so this doesn't represent the entire industry. This is just out of one installation manual. Quarter inch, we're typically in that 10 to 12. Yeah, and they're all pretty well in that ballpark.
But I love to grab a torque wrench, one of those digital torque wrenches. I just grab it in my hands and twist it, and I can twist it to about 20 pounds before my hands really start hurting on it. And that right there was over-tightening that flare, potentially cracking it, or stretching that copper where it's real thin, where maybe it doesn't crack today. You know, maybe we start the unit up and it passes our pressure test and passes our vacuum test. We start it up, we leave it. That line gets hot and cold. It expands and contracts, and then it cracks, you know, a week after we start the unit up. And golly, man, my flare's leaking again. Well, yeah, so we need to make sure that we do it right, you know. Let them see what 12 pounds feels like versus, you know, 60 something pounds that the large lines feels like. I mean, there's no way to know what tight feels like because all the different lines have, you know, line diameters have different torque requirements for them. And so the guys that are telling me, well, I've been doing it a long time, I know what it feels like to be tight. And, you know, sadly, if that were true, your flares wouldn't leak all the time. So maybe we do need to go back and start doing that. But we've got, like the picture shows there, you've got a digital torque wrench that makes it really easy. It's fully adjustable. We've got good flaring tools. So if we'll just show the kid, I say the kids, I use that word.
Students.
The students. Show the students. They're all ages, right?
Yeah. But younger me,
how to do it properly. You know, there really aren't big issues. I mean, I have two LG systems installed at my home, and I don't have refrigerant leaks. So
yeah, I've got
a lot of the indoor unit leaks that we get, you know, we'll get a head come back and oh, it's got a leak. And so they warranty and we get it back and there was no leak. You know, it was the fitting, absolutely, you know, time and time again. But
one of the things I love, you know, in class when I'm actually doing the torquing side of it is I'll go in. I like to have an old piece of equipment that, or if you don't have an old piece of equipment, you can actually go buy you a standard flare union and you can put it into a piece of metal and you can make a stand for, bolt it down to the table so it's good and solid. And then I'll have people come up and without using any torquing, using a couple adjustable wrenches, go, okay, tighten this for me. And then I'll let everyone tighten it and then use the torque wrench to actually measure how much torque it takes to back that off. Because typically about the force that we're seating is about the amount of force to unseat it. And so they can start looking at it. And then I'll also walk into the class and I'll look for the largest person in the class with the biggest hands.
Absolutely.
And I'll say, can I use you for an example? And I'll have them come up and I'll put my hand next to their hand. I'll go, do you think I'm going to be able to tighten something to the same thing that I feel is tight compared to this hand set of hands that feels like this is tight? Usually a football player, if I happen to find one, boy, they're fantastic. Everyone gets the example, right? Because there is such a difference. We cannot use our own judgment on tightening a flare. We absolutely have to have that. If it wasn't required in a manufacturer specification, it wouldn't be required for warranty purposes, right? So it is required for us to do this. Good comment that just came in just a minute ago from Tom. Tom, I completely agree. I should add an extra slide. I use these in class all the time. I should add a separate one showing proper ways for deburring, putting you a block on to give you a good hold so that you're not bending your copper. You know, we're going to use a torque style, and it's very important to understand that on our modern tubing cutters, we actually have an indicator for if we're working with soft copper or hard copper. So now we're using the proper tension on the sidewalls of the copper as we're cutting it to get a minimal burr. Then we're going to hold it down. We're going to even potentially use a block to hold it. We're going to make sure all of our burrs come out because most of our ductless systems don't have filter dryers on them, and they shouldn't have filter dryers. They have screens along the way for protection from things like EEVs, but that's all. So our debris can get hung up very, very easily, right? And now we need to make sure that we're going to be using a gauge as we're doing our flaring, right? In the past, I grew up with the nickel flare. I don't know about you guys, but I was always taught about using the nickel for using my flares. But I was typically working with 3/8 copper on refrigeration stuff. And that was always kind of the rule of thumb, was nickel thick. Well, now we start looking at it and go, all right, we have tools that have a measurement for cutting. We have a tool for measuring the depth with inside of our block. Very important to verify. And then we have a clutched style block. So we're using a determined amount of pressure for actually compressing and making our flare so that we're not over thickening it, causing it to harden and now become a washer instead of, you know, an actual seal between our two pieces of brass. And this is the funnest part right here. If you are teaching flaring in your classroom and you're not using a gauge, you are missing out on the fun, because as soon as you start putting gauges in the classroom, it becomes a competition. I will guarantee it. It's a competition to get good quality flares.
Yeah,
the only thing I would maybe add to that to the audience is I can speak for LG and maybe two other brands that I've played around with in my career. We all provide our own flare nuts for these systems. All right. I tell every distributor that I walk in across the country, stop buying line sets with flare fittings on them. Buy a line set that's raw. Number one, that's a better price. Number two, it's going to force you to make a good flare in the field. Right. Number three, it's going to force you to use the flare nuts that the manufacturers are shipping with their piece of equipment. All right.
Yeah.
They're typically bigger. The thread patterns are the same, but they're typically bigger, longer. Quality control is higher. It's just a lot goes in for that to be said about using the flare nuts that are provided from the manufacturer.
So true. I just look and I've got a whole bucket that I've taken off, and that's my scrap bucket, or that's my washers for when I'm practicing casting a bait caster. It's thrown it in a bucket. Anyhow, no, that you're 100% right. Cut those off. Use what came with the equipment. They are designed specifically for that. The tapers have been, you know, machined to be a perfect fit. And Paul, yeah, I got Paul. You're right. Yes, sir, we do. If you don't believe it, you just come on to the conference. You're going to see all sorts of older kids having fun. So when we get into the torquing, so now we've got two things we can introduce in the classroom. We got flaring that we can actually use for competition as well as evaluation, right? It's a fantastic tool for evaluating something in the classroom. We have our torquing to specification, which is massively important. And the tools aren't horribly expensive. Once you start using them, you'll never go back. I absolutely promise you. Now, what other options do we have in the industry that we need to be aware of? Let's talk about things besides just standard flaring, because we are starting to see, we've got jurisdictions not too far from here that are really starting to look down upon brazed connections for many reasons, right? They're wanting mechanical connections, but we need to be aware of the types of mechanical connections that are out there. And if we are using them, making sure that we are using them properly. So as a manufacturer, do you see many installations that are starting to use brazeless style connections?
Yeah, I see a lot of contractors that are moving this direction. And for several reasons, it's easier, it's quicker. You know, maybe they don't want to stop and teach their people how to flare, and maybe they were never taught how to flare. And, you know, once you use some of these alternatives, the speed and production time is pretty impressive. They still have to be used properly in every manufacturer, whether it's a push-on style connector, which there's a lot of debate in the industry, and I won't really weigh in there.
You have research on that, but we want to show you what's
at your discretion. You betcha. But you still have to prep your copper properly. It's got to be round. It can't be oval. You've still got to take the burrs out of it. And most of the manufacturers require that you scuff the outside. One of them, it was one of the press tools that I was talking to. They said, you can't use emery cloth. It's too harsh. And it'll leave too deep of a scratch. They want you to use the red Scotch-Brite pads.
Okay.
And I don't remember which brand that was. That's not an LG statement, but that's just something that I kind of picked up along the way, that, you know, you can't just take dirty copper that's kind of smashed and not round and shove it in and expect it to make a good seal. So, but yeah, I mean, a lot of guys are moving to those crimp style connectors, and, you know, LG doesn't have a stance on it, right? So we just want you to hook the line set up and not have a leak and not introduce any contaminants into the system, like with a brazing. If it doesn't have a perfect nitrogen purge, you're going to leave that carbon on the inside. That will definitely damage your system. Clifton talked about the screens right before the expansion valves, and it'll plug it up. It'll ruin a system really, really quickly. It's not hard for me to tell when a system was brazed in, whether they ran copper or whether they ran nitrogen or not, because it will do a lot of damage to that system if they're brazing it in without the nitrogen being dialed in there. So yeah, there's alternatives that are definitely becoming more and more popular for sure.
Yeah. And I always like to just be informative to our listeners. You know, you're probably, if you haven't already experimented with some of the brazeless connections, I'm sure you're going to. We're starting to see a lot of them. I've seen contractors that will solely use them. I myself have had mixed success with using them. I've had contractors do work for me when I was with a distributor, do a large installation, and had a significant amount of failure. So, you know, you can approach it different ways. If I'm a service contractor, Tom's got a great point. It leaves opportunity out there for quality repairs. But hopefully we're not giving our equipment the bad names in the process, but it really does come down to installation. You know, I myself have got a 4-port 3-ton that I've installed 5 years ago, and I've cleaned filters and outdoor coil, and that's it. It, you know, so exactly like you were saying, when they're done properly, flares are fantastic. And that's another, you know, that's a good point, Joe, that I'm kind of the same way on flare gaskets and Nylog. I have seen a lot of people discussing here in recent times utilizing on them. I personally don't have much of a stance on those. So I always enjoy, you know, success stories or failure stories from the industry on how things like that have worked for you, because we do have, you know, a variety of things being introduced into the industry, all trying to save time, trying to make the equipment, you know, a better, more successful installation, but it's only as successful as the time taken to prep things and actually make those connections. So I didn't want to spend too much time.
One,
yeah.
I'll make one brief comment about Nylog, and I don't want to get into it because there's people fight all day over that. But what we want to make sure is that no foreign substances enter into the refrigerant system. I've seen people use Nylog in different ways. I've seen it where they smear it all over the entire face of the flare. That is going to get in and that is going to contaminate the system. It is not made with PVE oil. We don't use POE oil in the inverter systems. Most or all of the Asian brands use PVE oil. That will contaminate it and cause problems. So if you're going to use a product like that, please just make sure that it's not entering into the refrigerant.
Yeah, absolutely. System. You know, here's a diagram to help you see. This is right out of an installation manual from a piece of equipment to help just look at the connections on this particular ductless system, which is very indicative of our industry as we're moving into inverters that are measuring the flow and measuring velocity and understanding that we do have variable refrigerant temperature or pressure, that it's not a constant that we're actually using the system to measure its own performance. And so any restriction that we would add into the system is going to immediately affect performance. And so when you start looking at modern inverter technology, you'll find the lack of filter dryers that are not recommended to be installed. I've seen many of them installed in the field and it breaks my heart every time I see one because they should not be there. You know, if we're doing our proper installation, proper evacuation, proper pressure test, we're going to have a sealed system that really wouldn't need a filter dryer unless there was some type of a contaminant in the system. So what we use on many of our electronic expansion valves are screens or filters. So you will not see that filter dryer word in our manuals anymore. And so it's important to understand that we need to just be more cautious on our installations than we have been in the past because our systems are relatively delicate, but not tender. They just need to be done properly, like we should have always been doing.
I'll make a comment real quick, if you don't mind, Clifton. I stand in front of folks all the time and I say, what we need to do is bring back the skill set to the trade. Okay.
That's all we're trying to preach.
Right. And the sloppiness that we've gotten away with.
Yeah.
With the HVAC trade, the sloppiness that have gotten away with that the system still tolerates and runs. That doesn't happen in critically charged refrigeration systems, which this ductless technology is exactly that. If everybody on your show would understand that this ductless technology is a critically charged refrigeration system. All right. And these mistakes, these sloppy installation mistakes are the root cause for probably 8 if not 9 out of 10 bad experiences with this technology.
Absolutely.
And so that's what I'm trying to, if I'm out in front of an audience, you'll see it next when I'm with you guys and you'll see it at AHR. That's my message. Let's get the skill back in the trade, right? The tools are better. The education's better. All we need now is the people to apply it.
100%. You know, I had a show with Ty Brandeman one time, and we were talking about this, and he pulled out one of his books from 1953 that showed proper evacuation, triple evacuation in 1953, you know, how to properly charge this R12 system. I'm like, that's really what we're back doing again. And so as educators, we really are responsible for teaching the generation the things that maybe we weren't taught as professionally as should have. You know, I know for myself, I didn't realize how bad of an installer I was until I started teaching. That's when I learned what I had been doing wrong all the time. Doesn't mean that I was taught improperly. I may have just been hard-headed enough that I didn't pick up on it. I don't know. But there were a lot of things that I learned as I started becoming an educator that really made me rethink the way our industry has progressed. And so let's talk about one of the requirements, the pressure testing that we are expecting to be done on these equipments to ensure that we do have a connection, whatever style connection we're going to be teaching and using.
I think lately I've seen more and more guys that are accepting this or realizing what's required. You know, it used to be when I would teach classes and go around, the common answer to what do you pressure test a system to is about 250 PSI. And some of the American manufacturers, that's in their manual. That's where they want you to pressure test to.
Right.
That's fine. If you're installing their brand of system, that's fine. And there's a lot of regulators, nitrogen regulators, that simply can't get up to 550 PSI.
Agree.
And so I think that's another limiting factor there. So they have to have the proper tools that will allow them to do a pressure test. But we require a 550 PSI test. And I tell guys all the time, and I think I stole this from Terry, but if you're using an analog gauge to look at the pressure, you're going to look at it and you're going to twist it just a little bit and convince yourself that it's not losing any pressure. Because if you're losing over a few minutes, 3-4 PSI on an analog gauge, you can't see 3 PSI.
No.
But if you use a digital gauge, and I'm a big fan of not using a gauge manifold. I don't use a gauge manifold for anything.
You don't see any.
I'll use we'll use an independent digital gauge, and I'll put it right on top of the core removal tool, and that's how I regulate and measure my nitrogen. And I can know very quickly whether I have a leak or not. And yes, this is the proper way to do it. I want you to spend an hour and 45 minutes doing your pressure test, but I also understand some reality too. But with a digital gauge, if I see that I'm losing 2 PSI over a 15-minute period, well, that may not feel like very much, but it's got a leak. So stop what you're doing and go back to work and find your leak and fix it before you leave the job site.
I have a phrase I use quite often. And, you know, I don't care what system it is, HVAC, refrigeration, there's three pieces, right? You make the refrigerant connection, you leak test, and then you evacuate and then you charge if it's a system needs refrigerant, right? So there's a new word that I use around the country that goes with each one of those steps. And that word is pass. So I leak test, pass, evac, pass, charge, pass. If I don't pass the first step, all the subsequent steps fail. And that's become a mantra of mine to get out here. If you're not passing your leak test, don't move forward. If you pass your leak test but can't pass your evac test, don't move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a staple of what that system will be performing down the road. Right?
It's critically charged. We understand. Like Philip knows, we looked at our engineering data the other day. Two-ton system for us is going to have 30 ounces of refrigerant in it, 30 of R32.
Yeah. Right?
That's not a lot of refrigerant. And if a leak at 2 PSI over 20 minutes, it's going to be gone in a couple of days.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's
a 2-ton unitary heat pump, you know, and I looked at a few of them, and I had one in my slot. I won't say the brand, it doesn't really matter, but it was like 180 ounces worth of refrigerant was what the pre-charged amount was. And now we're going to have 30 in the system. So, I mean, the charging is going to be so critical that we get it right. I mean, the 3 ounces that sit inside that refrigerant hose while you're charging the system is enough to make it work or not work. So we've got to make sure that we're doing the charging process properly, that we're purging the hose full of refrigerant before we start weighing it in. And of course, as we know or should know, that the only way to charge an inverter-based system like an LG is through the weighing method. There's no, I had a leak, so I had to top it off. There's no way to measure the superheat, the subcool, to where you can do any sort of a top-off process. The only way, and you know, hate it or love it, the only way is to evacuate all the refrigerant out of the system and weigh it back in. We highly recommend weighing in virgin refrigerant if and when you ever have to do that. But even on the install, just getting that, calculating the proper trim charge, not just, I know I had a long line set, so I'm going to add a little bit here or there. You know, I've seen that. I've had guys go, well, how much did you have? Well, I always put in a half a pound extra. It's got an accumulator, so I always put in a half a pound extra. I've literally been told that by a contractor, and it was just blowing my mind. That is not the reason for an accumulator. You know, we have a minimum line set length, and we have a maximum line set length, but, you know, an LG, most of them are pre-charged, single zone, or pre-charged for about 25 feet worth of line set. Anything beyond that, you do the math, you figure out how much extra line you have, figure out what the charge multiplier is for that system, which will change based on the diameter of the line set and is getting even smaller with the new refrigerants. R32 is a more efficient refrigerant than 410A. And so the volume is going down to about 75% of what we used to use. We're being able to use less refrigerant now, which is one of the reasons why we chose R32 over the 454B. I know that's not what we're here to talk about, but that was one of the driving.
I always like to hear why, because I get questions a lot. Why does one manufacturer use it versus another? Well, they all have their own.
And there's lots of reasons, but that benefit specifically goes into the new mitigation valves and the leak mitigation valves. Any system with less than 4 pounds of refrigerant in it, it doesn't matter the room volume, doesn't matter anything. You do not have to have any kind of leak mitigation valve on a unit with less than 4 pounds. So the R32, it has a higher efficiency than the 454B. If I'm remembering my numbers right, 454B is about 92% volume based compared to 410A, and then R32 is 75% compared to 410A. So both are a smaller charge, but R32 is even smaller. So that's going to give us an advantage when it comes to jobs where maybe you're on the border where if I have an R32 system, I don't have to deal with the leak mitigation valves. But if I use a 454B system, I might have to use the leak mitigation valve. So that was one of the reasons why we chose to go that route.
Yeah, no, that completely makes sense to me. And for those of you that, if you're not familiar with what we're talking about the M1, M2, M3 measurement standards for when we're talking about mitigations. We actually did an episode where we talked about that a little bit. It's been a while back. I don't know if I can grab it in time to throw it in the chat, but if you go to the YouTube channel, I've got a couple of them on mitigation strategies. One of them did with Jason was really good. We covered a bunch of that just to keep you update with where we are on that, because it is very important. If we can stay underneath of that, you know, it's 3.9 pounds and 4.1 pounds, depending on which refrigerant, but approximately 4 pounds is where we're going with that. So, you know,
Joseph made a good comment. If you want to pop it on the screen, in certain areas where they require an overnight test and the ambient temperature changes, you know, teaching the guys what happens as the outdoor temperature changes with a nitrogen, with a nitrogen pressure test, you know, does nitrogen change pressure with temperature? Yes. So how much? You know, 10 degrees Fahrenheit equals 1 PSI. Well, if you're dropping overnight from, you know, you set it in the afternoon when it was 90 and you get there in the morning and it's 60, okay, that's fine. How much should my pressure have dropped overnight? And knowing that, oh gosh, my pressure's 3 PSI lower. Well, no, that's weather related.
All right, so get to
My PSI is 8 pounds lower. Well, that's not weather related. That, you know, unless you're in Arizona where they have crazy swings,
sure,
that's probably actually a leak. And so teaching them what weather does to a nitrogen pressure test is probably something that should be covered.
Yeah, no, it should be.
None of that was discoverable until there were digital gauges.
Yeah, because you couldn't measure that. I mean, where did I put this? Even if I had a fine enough of a pin to put on my gauge or piece of tape, it's just not enough. It wouldn't have been able to do that.
Right.
No, absolutely.
And if you got an itty bitty tiny leak, you know, it may work great for 6 months, 8 months, 12 months. But the number of technicians that I've talked to that had to go back on a job 6 to 12 months later and found that it was low on refrigerant is unbelievable. Oh, and my hunch is a large majority of those had the leak at the beginning, or they over-tightened the flare and it cracked shortly after they started it up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'd encountered many of them. You know, when I was with the distributor, I did a lot of site visits for a manufacturer, and that was always one of my stipulations when I would get a call, especially if it was a multi-port or any ductless system. If they were having performance issues, you know, everyone wants you out there immediately. They want you out there right now. And that was always my stipulation. I said, I'll tell you what, let's do this real quick. I'd have them get out the manual. We would see what the additional refrigerant charge would have been over the factory charge. I said, okay, here's your number. You go recover that out. If you have less than that, you go find your leaks. If you have that, call me back and I'll come see you. Very rarely did I get that call back. Most people find when they recover that refrigerant that they did not have enough refrigerant in the system because they had a leak, and then they can move on to the repair. So it's so important to do this now. I mean, if we think about it, do we really want to come back and look for a leak? Because it's not going to be the leak that's going to get the bad name from the consumer. It's going to be the performance of the system that's going to get a bad name from the consumer.
Or the whole technology as a whole.
Exactly. Which is kind of where we're at.
Because LG or whatever brand it is a bad name. And it also stains the brand of the air conditioning company that put it in. You know, they recommended that brand. They recommended LG and they sold it to them. So everybody loses in that case. And so does the homeowner. Whether you cover it in warranty or not, you know, they still had to go out of their way to call you and wait for you to come out and maybe go a day or two without heating or cooling. Mm-hmm. So nobody wins. Service company really loses.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You bring up I have a slide that I put up in my presentations, and Philip's going to chuckle because he's seen it a million times, right? It's a billboard, a white generic billboard. Okay. Mm-hmm. And on that billboard, I'm standing in front of a group of contractors. Bill, I don't care. That billboard says, I fix mini splits, license number, phone number, because I have been doing this inverter driven work for 30 years now. And like I said earlier, 8 or 9 times out of 10, if that system is running, hasn't electrically failed, okay, I can almost bet you all the money in Texas that the refrigerant charge is incorrect. 100 people have been out there. That's an exaggeration. But 10 contractors have been out there and taking refrigerant in, put refrigerant out, blah, 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 blah. I go out there with a 500 PSI nitrogen regulator, find a leak, fix the leak, evacuate properly, pass, charge, pass, and leave a hero.
You bet.
And I tell all these guys all around the country, that billboard would be in your town, if I was 30 years old, not 68, that billboard would be in your town on the biggest highway you got. And I would own that town's business.
Yes. No, I agree. Like I said, I had one board failure that was legitimate. It did not have any overcurrent. It didn't have any type of surge protection on it. And it was installed in an area that had a brand new power station. They had very high voltage being very close to it. Other than that, it was almost always a refrigerant scenario due to a failed flare. That's how important this is.
Yes, sir.
You're right. We can find it in pressure testing. If we feel like we were good on our pressure test, we will find it in our evacuation.
Yes, we will.
Right. So we have two ways to verify. And this is such a good demonstration in the classroom. It is a perfect evaluation tool to see if they can actually get these to maintain below 500, which has been industry standard for a long time. I have been seeing installation manuals recently requiring 350 microns for 30 minutes, which I think is wonderful because there's no reason you can't. If you're doing it properly, you can. You can do all of this in a very, very short period of time.
If I can get to 500, I can get to 350, no problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you're setting it up right and have your right.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, not pulling through your manifold, not pulling through the Schrader core, and you're doing it right. It's not long, and the line sets are getting smaller. I mean, we use 1/4-3/8 on a lot of our stuff. The biggest line set we use is 3/3/5/8 on a single zone. And so it doesn't take very long to evacuate down to 250, 300 micron and hold there. So, you know, the bar is set at 500. You know, do you want to be just below the bar or do you want to go a little bit above and beyond? You know,
sure.
I heard somebody say one time they were talking to builders, but they said, you know what, when a builder says that they build their houses up to code, basically they're saying that they build the worst house they're legally allowed to build.
Bare minimum. That's it.
And it was like, oh, yeah, I love that statement. But, you know, just because 500 is the number doesn't mean you can't be better or shouldn't be better. You know, we should all strive to do the best.
Absolutely. You know, I just had an email from a local, very large contractor who hires a lot of recently graduated students from an HVAC Excellence accredited program in the area. He said they're fantastic. They know the fundamentals great. They're great, you know, they call them kids as well. He says, hey, they're great kids. If there's anything that I could ask from my school is to help them learn installation best practices from a new perspective, because they're going to ride along with someone who's been in the field. There's a good chance they may not be doing things properly. And that new student is going to start learning bad habits that have been around again. So if we can enforce, if we can use this as a primary test, you don't pass this course until we're meeting all of these criteria and we are holding this evacuation and we'll come in tomorrow and we're going to see how well you did. It's such a good tool to use in the classroom because if we can get that down pat, if we can teach a proper installation, the equipment will do the rest for us. Man, I don't think I can preach.
Oh,
Oh, great conversation stuff, gentlemen. I really, really thank you. You know, another thing that you had brought up, we were right at the time, but I wanted to talk just briefly a little bit about condensate management. A lot of people don't think about it, especially with ductless systems. And I'd love for us to kind of brush on proper condensate management, especially when we're talking about these ductless systems.
I live in Florida, just here in North Carolina, but I can tell you condensate management from where I live in the Gulf of Mexico and all the state of Florida is like high priority, because if we're not doing it correctly, there's water in people's ceilings, right?
Yes.
And I'm looking at this picture you got right here, and one of the worst things that I ever see on an install is that corrugated tubing that contractors are using. If you look in my install manual for a 7 or 9,000 BTU single zone, it's recommending 3/4 inch ID PVC schedule 40 as a minimum for drain line.
Yeah.
All right. So when you talk to these guys, all these educators are on here in this audience. I already made the comment once. If I got a colder coil and a slower fan speed in the air conditioning mode, what does that mean? That means I got a lot of condensate. Yeah. And it has to move and go somewhere.
It's doing
right?
it.
and so I can't speak for all the places, but a lot of places in the South, building code, HVAC mechanical code, requires that all horizontal runs of PVC be insulated with half-inch wall tubing insulation. I got a 35-degree evaporator coil, 34-degree evaporator coil, properly charged, properly installed, and properly sized, okay? That's 34-degree condensate water hitting the PVC in a 100-degree attic. Or 140-degree attic. It sweats profusely.
Yeah, just open your refrigerator. You'll know what we're talking about.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is we talk about condensate lifts.
Yes.
All right. Everything that we make that goes in a ceiling, from a ceiling cassette, a horizontal ducted air handler, those products have condensate lifts built in. They're not pumps, they're lifts. And if you understand the sequence of operation, if there's a compressor call, the pump is running. So no water is accumulating in the pan. Make sure everybody understands that, all right? If the compressor calls, the pump is running, no water's in the pan. What happens is all those systems have a vertical separation. In other words, the maximum that pump can lift water up, mm-hmm. guys are exceeding that. And that column of water, when the compressor call stops, that column of water comes back. You can't put a check valve in it because that lift can't pump against it. So that's what's creating the condensate nightmares. A, it removes more moisture. Look at a pint's removal. We publish it. It removes more moisture than any U.S. I don't want to use the word U.S. any traditional built system that you've been working with.
Right.
And B, it requires a larger drain line than everybody's running. That clear plastic tube.
3/8.
If people going to use it, right?
Too much of it.
It has mold, mildew, green slime growing on it before your truck got out of the driveway to leave. Right. So
I love this, guys. I love the passion in this. Obviously, everyone else is. We have so many people still hanging on. We're grateful that you spent a whole hour with us. Is there anything that you guys would like to touch on before we hop out here? Anyone in the audience have any last minute questions, things that we need to go back and regroup on? That's some really good stuff. Things that I've heard. Yes.
Clifton, while you're waiting on questions, so my topic for HVAC excellence.
Yes.
My presentation is ductless do's and ductless don'ts. All right.
It's right in, doesn't it?
And it's going to be this information, okay, in more detail. And man, nothing excites me more, if you can't tell, than getting a bunch of educated folks together and talk mm-hmm. about how we apply this stuff. Because here's my position. 30 some years ago, I saw this technology for the first time. Okay. 30. Since that time, and I own an air conditioning company in that 30 years, all right? Since that time, I've done one traditional built system. Everything else has been this technology.
Yeah.
Single zone, multi-zone, whole home heating and cooling, not porch air conditioning, okay? Whole home heating and cooling. If you understand the refrigeration cycle, which Philip talked about up front, that this is a better way to manage BTUs. This is a better way to make heating and cooling for people. And as evidenced by its growth in the sector and in the industry. Thanks, everyone, for being on here.
Yeah, and I'll say one last thing. Just, you know, the whole mindset of LG and some of these other companies, too, that make this technology of, you know, Terry used the word porch air conditioner or mini splits. Guys, LG is not a mini split company. We make mini splits, absolutely. Right. But we have everything from a 1-ton to a 5-ton air handler system. So the days of, you know, just using this technology for mini splits or for problem areas or whatever it is, yes, that's still applicable. But this is what's coming to change the industry for whole home heating and cooling.
I'm glad I'm not the only one out here ringing this bell.
That's my word.
This is fantastic stuff, guys. I'm so grateful you took the time to join us. It's wonderful to have our manufacturers bringing firsthand information here. It's what this whole community is about. It's learning the right things from the right people. And we really encourage you to hang out with us every week. We'll hit all these topics. Grab that Jot form and send me some things that you would like to learn more about. If there's manufacturers you'd like to have a better connection with, we encourage you to get over to lghvac.com, learn about the products and learn about the training. There's a lot on there about the training that LG is doing. And yeah, Osvaldo, you're right. This is the way our industry should be learning. We should be taking information directly from the manufacturer, putting it in the hands of the educators, and then spreading it like wildfires as much as we can.
Yeah, man. Sign up for our classes out there at HVAC Excellence. We'd love to see you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll guarantee I'll be swinging in there. Awesome. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you again next week on Did You Know? The ESCO HVAC Show.